From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. An auto bailout failed in the Senate. Now the Bush administration says it might find money from other bailout funds to keep the car companies from collapsing. Joining us to talk about the latest is Jerome Vaughn. He's the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Jerome.
Good to be with you.
So what happened with the bailout that was being negotiated, debated in the Senate?
Well, to answer that in a brief way, because it could take hours and hours and hours to sort of deconstruct it, the House passed a version of the bill a few days ago. The Senate dug its heels in. They really looked at it. Democrats, Republicans tried to come up with a deal, but Senate Republicans from the South really dug their heels in and said, this is not something that we want to pass. Senator Corker from Kentucky had a plan which would have required the United Auto Workers Union to dramatically cut wages, and the deal just fell apart throughout the evening. So this morning, many people in Detroit woke up and heard the news, and they've just been crushed so far today.
So have financial markets, and it seems as if there's been a circle on this issue where a lot of people were skeptical at first. Obviously, the Senate defeat of the moving forward of this bailout says that some people still are skeptical. But I think that over time, it seems that people who are in financial markets have become more invested in the success of U.S. automakers. Do you feel that that's the case?
I do. I think that the longer this goes on and the more conversation there is about it, people realize how well connected they are, that most people with 401ks in the United States probably have a share of one or the other automaker's stock, GM being such a big part of the Dow 500. So, people are starting to have an understanding of that. It's not gone far enough yet. Many people outside of the Midwest don't have that understanding of the importance of the auto industry to the country in the way that people are obviously connected to it in Michigan and Ohio and other Midwest states have an understanding of the issue.
What do you make of the White House saying that it might use other funds, including what are being called the TARP funds, the bailout funds, to try to work with automakers?
Well, I think the White House has an understanding of how dire the situation is, that these automakers, GM, Chrysler, say they need this $14 billion to get through the end of the year. I mean, this is not a package that, they can kind of put off for a long period of time. This is money they need right away. I think the White House is receptive to that. And I would guess that the White House is also saying, we don't want one or more of the automakers to fail on our watch, especially when, we've only got a month and a few days left to go until the next administration. Let's get them that far, and then the Obama administration can figure out what to do with it in a more long-term way.
Finally, what are the United Auto Workers doing to try to move things along, negotiate?
Well, President Ron Gettelfinger had a great news conference this morning, a rarity for him, and he really took the Republican senators to task for their reluctance to help out. Gettelfinger said, he had made offers for concessions and willing to work to get the deal done, and he said it was clearly politics involved, that was the only reason the Republican senators from the South weren't willing to back this bill.
Well, Jerome, thanks for the update.
My pleasure.
Jerome Vaughn is the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan, and he joined us from their studios. Now we're going to continue the conversation about the auto bailout and more of the week's top headlines on today's Reporters Roundtable. We've got Deidre Childress. She's the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend Magazine, and Chandra Thomas, a freelance reporter in Atlanta. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
So, Chandra, we just spoke with Jerome Vaughn about the bailout, and he framed an issue that a lot of folks are talking about, which is that some Southern senators voiced opposition to the plan, including both of Georgia's senators. So do you think there are regional differences over how people perceive the need for an auto bailout?
Well, obviously, in the northern states, like, of course, Michigan, because that is the main industry that is going to be a major concern. I think, but just generally nationwide, I think that the sentiment that I'm getting from the people that I'm speaking to is that no one is opposed to the actual bailout itself. They want to save jobs and they want to ensure that the economy does not continue on a downward spiral. But I do think there are some sticking points that are causing a breakdown in negotiations. And also, I think there's a big issue with making sure that this money is just not handed over, and that there are some stipulations and looking at major changes in the auto industry, particularly as it relates to more dependable, fuel-efficient vehicles, and also responding to the environmental issues.
Deirdre, from your perspective of seeing how people think about this in Philadelphia and what Philadelphia's interest is in this, what are you getting a sense of?
Well, I think some people have chalked off what happened last night to some mean-spiritedness. And I think that when you take a step back, you realize that what happens in parts of our country affect all of our country, and that our country's markets then begin to affect the rest of the world. So I think that when you step back and take a broader view of how important this industry is to so many things, you see what the real impact's going to be. I was surprised this morning to hear that because of the lack of advertising from the auto industry during the daytime, that daytime soaps are now being affected, of all things. And you don't realize that actors' salaries are being cut. And that goes right into the heart of the economies in New York and California. So when you think about this in a small way, in terms of, well, you know, the Midwest is suffering or Detroit is suffering, you really need to look further than that. And you need to look at the impacts across the country and eventually across the globe if the current administration doesn't come up with something that will save two of these three automakers by January.
When you give us a little taste of how people are doing in general. I mean, I think every place is dealing with its own personal crisis in terms of what it looks like, what this horrible downturn looks like for members of our communities. But Deirdre first, Philadelphia, what are the issues that are coming to the surface as we go through this economic crisis?
So many people trying to figure out how to get through the holiday season with a positive attitude. That has been a very big deal here. I mean, you go to the shopping centers. Last night, one of the malls had a men's shopping night, and they talked about having beer and pretzels out, and they do this every year. And last year, people didn't even come to drink the beer. It was pretty amazing. And I think that when you get into the households in our area, and people are talking to their children about, hey, don't expect anything big. I was talking to a woman this morning who said, my son is getting one video game and he kind of understands that he's getting the one game. I think that is where this is all playing out. It's playing out in our living rooms. It's playing out in our homes. It's playing out with our children. And it is really combining to give us one of the most desolate holiday seasons that I can remember. About a week ago, I was one of the 7 a.m. shoppers in one of the stores, and I was so surprised when I got there that I was the only person waiting for the store to open. And that told me a lot right there. I mean, it's a difficult time for people.
Chandra, what about Atlanta?
I think it's going on across the country, and Atlanta is no exception. People are spending less. People are cutting back. People are focusing on the difference between wants and needs. I know lots of people, obviously, in the media industry are looking at maybe doing career changes. Also, people are picking up part-time jobs, and people are getting more creative. They're figuring out ways to save money and to keep, you know, their money closer to them and keep that money in their purses and pocketbooks, because they know that, you know, there's a chance of losing jobs. And the fact that after the holidays, I think it's really going to take a major dive.
We're going to talk more about the media business in a second, including some big news. But first, I want to just quickly get your feelings on the ongoing case of Governor Rod Blagojevich of Illinois, who, of course, was arrested on a criminal complaint that said he tried to sell President-elect Obama's Senate seat to the highest bidder. There are ongoing negotiations over how the government should handle his position, whether he should be basically given the boot. Are people following this, Chandra, in Atlanta?
Oh, definitely. I think obviously because the close ties to President-elect Barack Obama, in the sense of it being in his state, and also being, you know, his Senate seat, definitely there's been a lot of, you know, talk about this. But it's interesting because there may be some naysayers or some pundits who would try to tie President-elect Obama to this, or in some ways implicate, you know, something. But it is very clear that he and President-elect Obama were never close. They kind of had always had a cordial, kind of distant relationship, with the exception of some support from a Chicago businessman who is under a federal indictment. But a lot of people are talking about this just because it is one of the most salacious scandals to hit that state in recent years. And obviously, with all 50 members of the Senate Democratic Caucus signing a letter urging Blagojevich to quit immediately, it lets you know that they are definitely trying to be proactive and take a stand on this.
All right, Deirdre, you get the last word before our break. Just quickly, do you think that Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., because his name has even come up in the context of this whole situation, whether or not he's the Senate candidate number 5 who was willing to do pay for play, do you think that his chances of getting the Senate seat are over?
I think it's really difficult. And I think the best thing that could happen for him would be some of the answers to the questions coming out as fast as possible. I don't think the questions can come out fast enough. And I was speaking to someone about this, and they were saying, you know, after all of the work he's done to build his reputation, to live to his name and beyond, it seems like there's a cloud there now. And I think it's going to be difficult. But the best thing that could probably happen for him would be for this to be cleared up quickly.
All right. Well, Deirdre and Chandra, stay with us. We are going to take a break, come back with more news on our Reporters Roundtable, and also look at the religious diversity of the Black community. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are back with our Reporters Roundtable. And on today's panel, we've got Deirdre Childress. She's the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend Magazine. And Chandra Thomas, a freelance print journalist based in Atlanta. I want to move on to a topic that we are all very familiar with. It's pink slip fever. And now the tech and media companies are really suffering. And this week, Yahoo began laying off 1,500 workers to cut expenses by $400 million a year. And our network, National Public Radio, has not been spared. We have had to cut more than 60 positions and 2 shows, including News and Notes. NPR has cited budget constraints in this economic downturn, and we will be on the air, I should say, until March 20th, here delivering the news with the usual alacrity and spirit. But these are tough times for all of us. Chandra, you mentioned that a lot of journalists are saying, hey, why am I in this biz? What do you think?
Definitely. The media industry is facing an unprecedented economic challenge, and obviously the country is. And I think of what a lot of people forget. Of course, there is a public service that is administered by the media, but at the end of the day, it's a business. And as people spend less, companies cannot afford to advertise, and obviously the ultimate result is a loss of jobs. As you mentioned, Yahoo laying off 1,500 workers. We have the Miami Herald being sold off by its parent company, McClatchy. We also have the Tribune Company filing for bankruptcy protection this week. And even here in Atlanta, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution this week announced that it's reducing its circulation and a net reduction of 156 full and part-time positions. Atlanta Magazine, my former employer, laying off several people in August. And then Atlanta Peach, which is a monthly magazine, or was a monthly magazine in Atlanta, unexpectedly closing. So as we see, this is a business, and as ad revenues slow up, there's going to be a loss of jobs.
Deirdre, some people, you know, basically have said, look, this is a time for greater diversity in the media industry than ever because of the changing demographics of the country, because of the recent election, because of the dire straits that we're in, and the fact that we need to represent the needs, concerns, news coming from all communities. At the same time, you have the National Organization of Black Journalists and many other groups saying it looks like we're going to see a shrinkage in the pool of black reporters, reporters of color, reporters from many different backgrounds. How do you think that our business is going to try to address the needs for broad-based reporting at a time like this when there appears to be very little money in the business?
Well, I am the national secretary for the Black Journalists, and I think it's really at the forefront of all of our minds in the organization, because the first thing that seems to suffer in this kind of cutback is diversity. And one of the things we're doing is really pushing the idea that all of our folks need to retrain themselves for multimedia. And that's going to be difficult in this year, because if the media companies are cutting back, they're cutting back their sponsorship. And that means that we don't have as much money to fund training for our members. So it's going to be a big balancing act, and we're going to tackle a lot of these issues when we meet in January. One of the things that we're already doing to help our members is we have a committee that is extremely focused on reinvention. We're coming up with, you know, solutions like free conference calls where we talk to people about the layoffs. We're talking to some folks right now about links to different job sites. We are really tackling this from a multi-prong approach. It's just been so devastating that amongst the board, we don't even have an opportunity to call everyone that we hear is getting laid off anymore. That's how widespread and how painful this is. And it's really difficult. But if you think of the auto industry and how you need to train and reinvent people for new jobs, you need seed money. And that's going to be a critical thing for our retraining of journalists. A lot of our journalists may still be able to be on the air, to be in print, if they freelance for some positions. But again, that loops back around to you're freelancing and you're trying to make, you know, three or four paychecks equal one. So it's definitely a very difficult time. I work at the Inquirer and our sister paper, the Daily News, this week. Our guild announced that we're going to have about 35 layoffs. And that we'll probably lose some jobs in management. And that makes it really difficult. I mean, the idea that you're sitting at your desk and a vice president or someone is going to tap you on the shoulder in about a week or so and say that by the end of the year, you're not working there anymore is really, really straining folks and making it a difficult time. But the best thing we can all do
under while you're under the gun. You know?
Yes, exactly. And I know you guys are feeling that. When we saw the news about NPR, we all just, you know, took a step back, because we've had such great sponsorship from your company and from your organization. And it just, you know, it really has an impact on folks in our industry. And we're going to have to figure out ways to do it, new ways to do it, and faster and definitely cheaper ways.
And Chandra, we got the chance to actually spend some time with you when we went down and broadcast from Atlanta. That was something that was very important to us.
Yes.
Do you think that, you know, a lot of people who I speak to about people's priorities say that the news is not one of them? There is no evidence that there's an erosion of NPR's audience, which is another whole economic question. It's a money it's a revenue issue as opposed to an audience issue at this point. But in general, do you think people invest in being news consumers at times like this when they have so many other priorities?
I think that people are now in survival mode. And when you're in survival mode, I think that that becomes less of a priority. You're thinking, how do I keep food on the table? How do I keep my job? How do I pay for gas and those type of things? I think that people do want news. I think part of this is also indicative of a shift in our industry, in that there are so many more news sources, and newspapers in particular are being hit very hard in this shift. And I think that, as my fellow panelists mentioned, a lot of journalists are having to reinvent themselves and also think multimedia. I recently coordinated a student journalism workshop at Clark Atlanta University, and one thing I emphasized to the students is, gone are the days of I work for a paper, I work for a TV station or a radio station. Multimedia is the solution, and I encourage them to be multimedia, because the traditional media as we know it is transitioning into the whole multimedia format, and to be prepared, journalists will have to retrain themselves, reinvent themselves to do video, to take pictures, and to, you know, deal with audio and video clips. And it's just, I think the economic situation is exacerbating it, but also I think this shift was going on in our industry for quite some time.
Well, we certainly have been fortunate enough to have a great team of people working on our web property, News and Views. It's nprnewsandviews.org. And so many people have come on to share with us their thoughts about the media, the economy, offered themselves up to come on our air. And also we're having an active discussion of the show and NPR and just having a conversation. So I want to make sure people know about that. And this conversation will continue. I really thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you. It was great being here.
Thanks. We were speaking with Chandra Thomas, freelance print journalist based in Atlanta. She's written for Essence, People, and Time.com, and she joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. We also had Deirdre Childress, editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend magazine. She's also the national secretary for the National Association for Black Journalists, and she joined us from Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. This is NPR News. On News and Notes, we bring on voices that reflect the diversity within the Black American experience, and that extends to religion. This election season put the Black religious tradition in the news and under the microscope, but there is a broader canvas of Black spirituality, one that includes religious diversity, conflict, and collaboration. We're going to kick off a conversation with Barbara Savage, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of Your Spirits Walk Beside Us, The Politics of Black Religion, and also Obrey Hendricks. He's a minister and author of the book The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus's Teachings and How They've Been Corrupted. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. By the way, I'm not a minister. I'm a professor of biblical interpretation.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. So, Barbara, I want to start with you. Congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
Religion's played such a major role in the organization of social movements in America. So what do you think has been the evolution over these past just couple years as there's been, I think, a wider audience looking in on what the Black church is?
Well, over the last few years, I think that we've seen kind of the culmination of the long history of diversity among African-American believers. I think that the certainly belief and the belief in the possibility of change and of a future that's better than today, something that I think that we've seen historically, this notion that there's an emancipatory potential in African American Christianity, for example, and in other systems of belief as well. And so it seems to me that one of the core aspects of African-American social progress is this idea of looking into a future and of not giving up and of being able to have some faith that, in fact, tomorrow will be better. I mean, that's a very basic understanding, and I think it's something that we see playing out even more dramatically in the last few years with the emergence of Black megachurches, churches that are large and very financially prosperous, some of whom have dedicated their resources to community improvement and broader social movements. So there are a lot of aspects of that, but I think that's one that comes immediately to mind.
Obrey, when you look at the framing of religion, both within discussions in the Black communities around America and also as those as our communities interact with the larger American community, how do other religions play into the picture, other religions besides Christianity? Is there an active dialogue about what role they play in African American communities?
No, I maybe increasingly, incrementally increasingly, various forms of Christianity sort of have the center stage. But Islam is, is growing quite rapidly in America. But it remains, at least from observation, pretty insular. And so, we haven't seen any real significant participation by the Islamic community or Black Baha'is or the Santeria or any of those in the political process and in the community development. So, if you look at it in terms of their social involvement in the larger issues of society, we don't see they're not perceived as major players at this time yet.
Do you think, Barbara, that's going to change over time?
I think it can change over time. One of the interesting things always about religion and the religious institutions that we ally ourselves with is that they are so idiosyncratic that they turn on what individual communities want. And so I think one of the conflicts that we've seen even among African-American Christians is the degree to which individual churches want to be involved in social movements or want to move outside of the question of individual salvation or taking care of one's own. And so I don't think that there's anything intrinsic in theological terms that would prevent other religions outside of Christianity from engaging those questions and really becoming more visible and becoming more politically active if they should choose to do that. I think among the freedoms that African Americans have been able to exercise most dramatically is religious freedom, and that includes the question of what kind of religion and the relationship between one's religion and broader social problems.
I think there's a lot of African Americans turn to alternative, we might call the alternative religions to Christianity, as much out of cultural concerns as spiritual concerns, and sometimes political. Many in my generation turn to Orthodox Islam or to the Elijah Muhammad's brand of Islam as a rejection of Christianity or rejection of Western culture. And that's why, and so they get ensconced in the cultural concerns. We see this in with Orthodox Muslims quite a bit. They get so involved in the cultural aspect of it that they tend to be particularly apolitical when it comes to the larger issues of society.
Both of you use the word politics in the title or subtitle of your books. We don't have a lot of time, but Aubrey first, why do you think religion is so integral to how politics play out for Black Americans?
I think it's integral. I don't know that politics and religion are. It's not always directly. There's not always a direct relationship.
When I say politics, I don't necessarily mean electoral politics. I mean the broader cultural politics.
Well, because the Black Church, being the major institution and place where Black people have had freedom of speech, religion, and have come together as community. I mean, that has been the center and the locus of us for so many years of all the social and political activity. And so they were conflated. And for the few churches that really saw Jesus as a liberator, it moved them to resist. Others came together for comfort and succor as in response to to political stimuli.
Barbara, just quickly.
Yes, I see African-American religion and politics as being innately intertwined, both historically and I think in the contemporary period. And part of this, as Aubrey says, comes from the fact that Black churches and Black religious institutions more generally remain the strongest and I think the most free institution in African-American communities. So this is also, a debate or a discussion about the dearth of other institutions or other community-controlled places where social and political work, can be achieved and accomplished. Churches are enormously convenient organizing sites and communication sites, and there's not much that competes with them in that way still. I think that's been true historically, and it remains the same today.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We were speaking to Barbara Savage, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, author of Your Spirits Walk Beside Us, The Politics of Black Religion, and Obrey Hendricks, the author of the book The Politics of Jesus. He's also a professor of biblical interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary. And next on News and Notes, does the black community need its own internet browser? We'll find out why one entrepreneur says absolutely. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We just talked to two scholars about the politics of religion in the black community, and now we're going to focus in on a couple of religions and religious practices that have devout followers, but not as many as mainline black Protestantism. How does that affect religious worship and identity? Cherie Curry is a journalist and editor of blackandjewish.com, and we've also got Anthea Butler, visiting scholar at Harvard Divinity School. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great. So, Cherie, let me start with you. By the name of your website, it's clear that you're talking about being black and Jewish, but you weren't born Jewish. What path led you to the religion?
I took a comparative religious class in high school, and all the religions that were compared, I felt a connection with Judaism. And when I got to college the following year, I looked more into it and began a conversion process.
What was it that attracted you to Judaism?
What specifically, at this point, it was so many years ago, I can't quite recall. But it was within the attention to, you know, just, I apologize, it's how the kind of religion, the family values within the religion, the focus on God more so than on an intermediary, that also was important to me.
Well, Anthea, let me turn to you. You've done a lot of research on Christian faiths, including Pentecostalism. Give me a sense of, and these are two very different religious traditions. One of the differences, obviously, is we're talking about Judaism and Christianity, but also there's a lot of differences between Pentecostalism and some other forms of Christianity. What are those differences?
Well, part of the differences, and I think here's the place where perhaps the Jewish and the Pentecostal connect more so than we might like to think, is the idea about disciplinary bodily practices. And I think for Pentecostals, the act of fasting, prayer, shouting, dancing, especially for African Americans, ties back to traditional slave religion. And these are the kinds of things that are more appealing, let's say, than a quiet liturgical experience being held in some other type of churches. And the other thing about Pentecostalism, too, I think, is that it gives you a place in which to deal with the supernatural, let's say. There's real evil in the world. There are evil things that happen. And especially for African Americans with a legacy of slavery and all, we don't, you know, we may not talk about these things very much. And it's a manner in which you can acknowledge evil, but you can also acknowledge that God can triumph over evil as well.
What role did Pentecostalism play in the development of black communities, particularly in the South?
Well, what's very interesting is that Pentecostalism, I like to say, is the glue that holds the pre-migration period and the migration period together. And by that I mean you have small rural Pentecostal churches that get started after the Azusa Street Revival, some that are in existence before 1906. And then what you have during the Great Migration period is the connection between churches like Church of God in Christ that are based out of Memphis that have big centers in places like Detroit and Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, and others. And as you have this movement back and forth, these churches continue to meet in southern places. The Church of God in Christ has met in convocation in Memphis for probably over 100 years. And that, it makes for a very interesting way to carry traditional African-American cultural practices back and forth from the South to the North.
Cherie, let me turn back to you. We have had many conversations on our show about faith in the Black community and have talked to people who were born into Judaism as well as people who converted. Do you ever feel as if, I'm assuming that you go to a majority non-Black synagogue, is that correct?
Yes, I affiliate with the conservative Jewish movement, and majority is not people of color, right?
Do you ever feel isolated within your synagogue?
I do not, actually, and I have moved around a lot in the 20-plus years that I have been Jewish, and so I belong to a lot of different synagogues, and I have never felt as if I were on the outside within that community. It doesn't mean that people don't, you know, inquire, you know, were you born Jewish, how did you become Jewish, and they all want to hear that story. However, otherwise, it's, you know, it's business as usual. You're there to pray. You're there to celebrate a holiday. And I don't feel that there's any difference there.
What about the issue of conversion? When you talk about being part of the conservative Jewish tradition, there are many different branches and groups, but there's Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, and my limited understanding, admittedly, is that some people make a distinction between people who are converts and some people don't in terms of things like lineage, where Judaism is often viewed to be something that passes from mother to child. How do you perceive people's relationship to you as a convert, aside from race?
Well, in general, I think, for one thing, I guess, even though I do also know people of color who were born Jewish, you know, whether because one parent was or whatever have you. However, it still is a big presumption that I converted. So I can say that I wear my conversion on my sleeve. You know, there are other people, Caucasians, who convert who probably don't get noticed as much. So I would say, again, the biggest difference there is that I'm usually asked more often than not about the process. You know, why did you convert? How did you convert? Just as your first couple of questions were to me, I do hear those questions a lot. So I say that's probably the biggest difference. Outside of that curiosity, as some people would, even if this was a Caucasian person who had converted, if they knew that, they may also ask the same questions of that person. But in terms of being treated differently within the conservative Jewish movement because I am a convert, I, again, do not find that to be the case. I do know there are differences if you were within the within different communities in terms of what's allowed and what's not. For example, an Orthodox person who is come from the line of Kohen, we call them, from the priests, like somebody like whose last name might be Cohen, for example, that they're not allowed to marry someone who converted to Judaism. So,
Well, let me give Anthea one last chance at bat. Do you see Pentecostalism and other charismatic traditions growing or decreasing in numbers at this point?
Well, right now around the world, if we take everybody, it's over 500 million people. So it's growing at an exponential rate. And in the African-American community, more often than not, if you think about the T.D. Jakes, Creflo Dollar, all those kinds of people, plus, you know, people like Charles Blake in Los Angeles and others, the African-American Pentecostal churches are much larger than these traditional churches that you probably previously talked about, AME, or some Baptist churches. So, yes, they're growing at an exponential rate. And I think, especially for African-Americans, they find themselves more comfortable in these kind of church environments than they do in what we would call the traditional Black church environment.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We were speaking to Anthea Butler, visiting research professor at Harvard Divinity School, and Cherie Curry, journalist and editor of blackandjewish.com. What if you had one central location for all black content online, a place where black-focused information was at the top of an internet search, where you could connect through social networks with like-minded people. Is that a step forward or segregationist? It's not a theoretical question. On Sunday, a group of entrepreneurs launched Blackbird, a web browser designed for African Americans. And today we've got Blackbird CEO Ed Young with us. He was one of the original co-founders of The Source magazine, and he's the CEO of Blackbird. We also have Harry Allen. He is the brain behind the blog Media Assassin, which you can find at harryallen.info. Hi, guys.
Hi, Farai.
So, Ed, you and I have not talked in a long time. Tell me what's different about your browser.
What is different about our browser is that it's a regular browser at face value. But one, two, or three clicks away, you have access to the expanded content that is available on the web that's targeted to the black community. And so what we didn't want to do is segregate out black from the web, but we wanted to pull that which is targeted to the black community into the web in a much easier fashion. If you wanted to create this on your own, we've had people say, well, are you saying black people don't know how to Google? And it's not just black people, mind you. This is for anybody. We don't do a color test when you download it. It's available for anyone to download, and we really believe it gives a richer browsing experience. But what it does is it gives you access to content that does not show up easily. In our Blackbird search, as we call it, or Black search, when you do a search with us, all of a sudden the sort includes 150 and a growing number of content sites that include content targeted at the black community that is available in a regular Google search.
Well, I want to bring Harry in here because, Harry, you're someone who looks a lot at not just the functionality and the tools of the internet, but how people use it. So how does the idea of this, as well as the execution, track with how you think black folks use the internet, different types of black folks?
Well, it seems that what Ed Young is describing is a piece of software that allows one to dig into the web and the internet more deeply. And by that I mean, even when you do any kind of search, what comes up in what place it comes up works according to certain algorithms in the browser. And either by the use of different algorithms or by focusing more closely on certain kinds of search terms or other kinds of ways to find content, it seems that what this software is trying to do is bring that content, black focus or African-American focus content, more to the fore. It's almost like, I guess, analogously, if you were to say, I'm in this city and I can go to this restaurant or McDonald's or whatever, but there's this one little place on the corner that nobody knows about that serves really good rice and beans. And if you know how to find that place, you're going to have a really good meal. So if I understand what this is supposed to do, it's supposed to pull out the content that's focused on African-American people that may not necessarily get up to the front, just the way that small little dive that serves that good food doesn't.
That's a great analogy, Harry. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
No, really. What it's doing is, and by the way, when you do a search with us, there's also a radio button right there that allows you to test it, to look at the regular web search, because it's the same search results. It's just sorted differently. Mm-hmm. And so most people, when you think, have you ever done a search and found something on the first or second or third page from Ebony or Essence? It's just not going to happen unless you put Ebony or Essence in the search query. What we've done is brought it forward.
Ed, I just have to ask you about Whitebird. It's a spoof. I mean, I guess.
I'd say it was brilliant in its spoof. It was well done. I have to give them credit for that.
Yeah. So it's Whitebird, a browser for white people. Right. White people sports takes you to a tennis site. White people recreation takes you to a North Carolina country club. Sounds like you're good natured about the spoof, but a larger idea of whether or not something that's black focused in what the way that your project is segregationist. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that the Whitebird browser, the spoof, actually helps to prove the point, because if you look at where the download points, it points to Apple Safari. And that's the point. It's not that Internet Explorer or Firefox or Safari or whatever other regular browsers in their incarnations are white bird browsers, but effectively they are because of the way the population in America is distributed.
All right, I have to go back to Harry. I know we have such a little amount of time. But Harry, what do you think? Just your quick 2 cents on whether or not this is segregationist to have a project that is black focused in its use of technology.
If I understand what the creators of the software are trying to do, they're trying to find content that people are having a hard time or a harder time finding otherwise. So why that segregationist seems to be unclear to me. Like why would that? It's like saying, well, if I go to a black library, that's segregationist.
Correct.
That's information I'm going to have a harder time finding otherwise.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to
have to. In addition to, not only. Segregation is when you say only. We're saying this is in addition to, and it's for everybody.
All right. That's the last word. Ed, Harry, thanks.
Thank you, Farai.
We were talking to Ed Young, CEO of Blackbird. He joined us from WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. And Harry Allen, he maintains the blog Media Assassin at harryallen.info. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York.